tape two, side four, still July 2, 1998. We're talking about Art and Antiques magazine. Barry has been a contributor many times. Okay, what else do you want to tell us about?
Final note on, first of all, on the political stuff, is that this president that you see, President Franklin Pierce, by far the most obscure American president, the 14th, two before Lincoln, is a particular passion of mine because I've spent 20 years researching and writing partially a biography of Franklin Pierce, which has finally been approved by Knopf and will appear as a book in about 2 years when I finish it. So I'm very excited about President Franklin Pierce, who has an unbelievable story that I won't tell you. But to come in probably the year 2000, is the Franklin Pierce story. The Art and Antiques story, I'll just tell you one other thing, which is that the funniest thing and the best line I think I had in that magazine was they asked me to do a story on the Will Rogers Museum, Cowboy Ranch and Museum in Pasadena, outside of, you know, suburban L.A. And Will Rogers is... Oh, yeah, there it is. We all love Will Rogers, but, you know, Will Rogers. So I went to the ranch, and it's beautiful. It's everywhere. It's all Indian, you know, rugs and stuff. You know, there's not a lot to say about it, but I tried to do it all right. Anyway, for the lead, I had Will Rogers. He never met a Navajo rug he didn't like.
I like that. Now, you also have had articles in Interview, Cosmopolitan, Opera News, Vogue. I can go on and on and on. Anything that's exciting that you'd like to tell us about something?
One, and I happen to have it. So I don't jump up and leave and you get mad at me.
I'd like to know, can I back up? What did you mean, like Will Rogers?
Well, it's a play on his famous line, I never met a man I didn't like.
Right, okay.
Because there's Indian rugs all over the place, and everything is Navajo. So it was just slightly bitchy comment on the...
Your bitchy
my
comment.
Take, yeah, by me on the on this particular institution, which was quite nice, and I was cruel to even say that, but...
No, I'm just... I gathered that, and I just wanted to get... Okay.
It wasn't that bitchy. It was funny, but there were some nasty letters to the editor saying, why is parents making fun of Will Rogers? Anyway, I can't help it. American Institution.
That's
So I would say of the articles, Interview, Opera News, Cosmopolitan. Yeah, I mean, the most enjoyable to me, well, I can't say most enjoyable, because I enjoy them all. Especially all the opera, you know, these days, I have a thing coming out in Vanity Fair in the August issue, September, about Andre Previn's opera, Streetcar Named Desire, which I'm very excited about. But to answer your question about the previous stuff, one of the pieces that I enjoyed the most was a cover story for American Film on Robert De Niro. And this was also a long time ago, 1989, because he at that point had not given an interview to anyone in 7 years. And he was a very, very private, pathological, silent person. And
my favorite.
Yeah, I mean, he's an astonishing artist. And that was a great privilege to spend a few days with him and try to get him to... He's not a real verbal person. And he's a very shy person. He's very small. I was in the restaurant for 3 minutes looking around for somebody, for him, until I realized that a man in the telephone next to me, who was about that tall, was Robert De Niro. He had glasses on. He looked nothing like I expected. He's very nice, very sweet, very shy, and very nonverbal. And he says, one of my favorite... I said, well, is it true that Scorsese asked you to do Christ in The Last Temptation of Christ, and that you turned it down before Willem Dafoe? He said, yeah, that's true. I said, well, why did you turn that down? He said, oh, I said, Marty, I can't get into Jesus. I said, in other words, I can't get into Jesus. They're the same words. He says that all the time. He says, in other words, and then he'll repeat, he's not a real articulate person. He's extremely intelligent, but he's just not verbal. And that's why he does the role. He can do any role, but he can't talk about it very easily. So it was difficult and challenging and fun to try to
Did you see his artwork at all?
De Niro's? No. Does he do? I didn't
yes,
even
his
know
father's
he
father's an artist, and I'm just curious.
I forgot that. I didn't even know that. You should have been with me, Mary. I hope that interview along. I could have used some help on that one.
Yeah.
Tell us about Previn.
About?
Andre Previn.
Previn, great. He is a longtime favorite from his 10 years that he was conductor here. He and I became friends. And I did a million interviews and articles with him. And I was also the most outraged at the point when the idiot board of the Pittsburgh Symphony released him, allowed him to go in 1984 over a battle with the particularly idiotic symphony manager, whose name was Marshall Turkin. Basically, the symphony board had a choice between letting Andre Previn go or Marshall Turkin, the manager, and they decided to let Andre Previn go for reasons that are too stupid to go through. But I wrote some pieces about it and did some rant and rave things on WQED, which, and I must say, was the only person who did so, because everybody else kowtowed to the money groups in town that run the play. And so Andre wrote me some letters, and we became even better friends after he left Pittsburgh. To shorten the story, and Myrna, he loves Myrna's, he said she has the best Russian singing diction that he ever heard, on the Alexander Nevsky. So, the Prokofiev. Anyway, to shorten the story, he has just finished writing an opera version of A Streetcar Named Desire, which, of course, is the greatest American play.
Yeah.
It's to be premiered at the San Francisco Opera in September, and I have done. Here's the galley. It's a 27-page article about it that will be in the September issue, which comes out in August, of Vanity Fair.
Have you heard the music?
I have had a sneak preview of the music, yes.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting. It's as somebody says here, it's not modern music, it's not a cat in the Cuisinart. It's accessible. Parts of it are very beautiful. Parts of it are harsh. If you've heard any of his other compositions, mm-hmm. it's like those. He is a sort of a his composing style is a little bit not similar to, but on the order of Strauss, Richard. It's a, like, postmodern, but still kind of romantic.
Didn't they premiere the Every Good Boy That Gives Favor or Does Fine or
mm-hmm.
whatever? That was very accessible.
It was very accessible. And also funny.
And the music was good.
That was written by Tom Stoppard. And,
The play.
Right. Or the libretto or whatever
right.
you want, the text. And then Andre did the music. Matter of fact, I mentioned that in here because that was typical. This man is such a genius. And I say here in one paragraph, in one short period, in one spectacular period during his tenure as music director of the Pittsburgh Symphony, Previn conducted, this is all within the space of about 6 weeks. Well, no, maybe 3 months. He conducted a dozen subscription concerts from Bach and Beethoven to Penderecki for the Pittsburgh Symphony. He premiered the music drama Every Good Boy Deserves Favor, which he wrote with Tom Stoppard, the playwright. He performed the jazz benefit concert with Ella Fitzgerald on the piano. He studied Frank Zappa, the rock star's score Bogus Pomp for a Pops concert. And at the last minute, he subbed for an ailing soloist at the Pittsburgh Symphony by playing Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 24 himself, quote parentheses, one of four or five that I keep at the ready, and conducting from the keyboard. Now, there is no other...
You think he's a genius?
He is an absolute genius. He's also won, of course, 7 Academy Awards for film scores. He is an incredible jazz pianist, as well as classical. He is the composer of these pieces. He is one of the best conductors in the world. There is nothing that he can't do and hasn't done. He is the most versatile single musician that I can think of in the this part of the century. I mean, you can't think of another one. The only one you could compare him with is Bernstein, who's a much greater conductor and composer, but who is not a performer and can never do, you know. In terms of the number of things, Previn is the greatest. But I'm prejudiced because I love him as a friend also. And this piece in Vanity Fair
His Hollywood career was amazing.
It was incredible. He did 50 film scores. As he said, 2 or 3 of which are memorable. But he got 4 awards, for My Fair Lady, for Gigi, for the Billy Wilder film went to. He didn't write the music, the original
music.
No. His four Academy Awards. This is important.
I can't borrow this. And
oh, I'd get you a copy. This is my original galley, but I'll get you one.
Please.
I won't make you wait until September. Academy Awards were for Gigi, 58. Porgy and Bess, 59. Irma La Douce was an original score.
Right, okay.
And My Fair Lady. So the other three he adapted. But his greatest other scores were films like A Bad Day at Black Rock, Designing Woman, Elmer Gantry is a particularly good one, Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, Billy Wilder's 1, 2, 3, and Kiss Me Stupid, Long Day's Journey into Night, and Inside Daisy Clothes.
And then his jazz career was quite amazing.
He has 4 dozen jazz albums. He has 50, 48
and he was
jazz.
I don't know.
It was horrible. It was horrible what they did to him here.
We don't go to concerts, so I'm not listening to the same people trashed him. Why, I don't know. Do you know you're very
They
active
never knew what they had. They never knew who they never knew the jewel they had. And one of the worst, he's a good friend of mine, is Robert Crown, the Post-Gazette, who picked him to death for 10 years. And I like Robert, but he was awful to Previn. And the whole city, though, they thought, oh, yeah, Andre Previn's here, you know. They never realized until he was gone. Lorne Mazel is the biggest cold fish in the universe. A great conductor, but not the musician.
Well, you didn't think he was?
I never liked him.
You didn't like him?
Never. I still don't. I can't stand him personally. He's a very unpleasant person. Musically, he's a great conductor.
Maybe tell me about WQED.
I'm not done trashing people yet. The musician.
No, I'm sorry. Go on.
No, I am done. Go on. I'm kidding.
We interviewed his father. He was delightful. Okay.
Lincoln.
You should finish on Mazel.
Whose father, Lincoln?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. He's wonderful.
Charming.
And Marie.
Well,
I love his parents.
She was interviewed also.
They were wonderful.
He was too busy.
Him, I could live without. Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. He was too busy.
So we got on with your WQED career. Tell us about that. I know.
Why?
I've
you
heard
have to be more specific.
To, well, all right.
It's been 16 years.
The Sunday Arts Magazine?
I co-founded that with Dennis Bartel and what was that, 81? Oh,
82.
God, that's horrible.
It says here.
16 years. Yeah, and I've been through a lot of other co-hosts, but I'm the only one that's been the same.
That's an interesting program. I like it.
Do you?
Uh-huh.
Thank you. It's the only thing of its kind here, and actually, I think it's pretty boring sometimes,
no,
most of the time. But
know what's going on.
Every now and then, yeah, it's a way to find out what's going on. We need to get it to do something to liven it up a little bit, because it is a bit on the dull side. But it is functional, it serves its purpose, and it has certainly been steady. 16 years, there aren't too many radio shows that have been ongoing that long. But I also do other, I do film, I've done film and music reviews and special reports for them. And they have been very nice to me. When I was fussing and feuding with the Post-Gazette, which I did for years, and hired and fired and in and out, CeCe Summer would always hire me back, would let me come and work a bit at QED to pay the rent. And I always appreciated that, and I will never forget that. So they're, you know, they pay nothing because they're public radio. But they've been very good to me, and I love the station and believe in the station.
Have you anything to say about what's happening currently
with the
station?
Well, you mean with the QEX
yeah.
and this, all that stuff? No, because I don't know anything about that. When I say QED, I mean the FM radio station,
mm-hmm.
and I know and have not ever worked for the TV station. And all that stuff, I can't say one thing, yeah, since I'm being in honest mode for history. The troubles at that station have all been over the TV. The TV, it's 3 units. It's WQED-TV, WQED-FM, and Pittsburgh Magazine, right? Those are the 3 units of the corporation, and of which the TV side occupies, I would say, 85% of the budget. And the poor little old FM station and Pittsburgh Magazine are left to share the rest, right? We, the FM station, have always operated in the black. And I don't know about Pittsburgh Magazine, it probably hasn't. But the TV side is the one that has gotten into all the trouble because of the extravagances of Lloyd Kaiser and Tom Skinner in the 70s and 80s when they had the Big Bucks National Geographic special contract. And the scandal of a few years ago when they were booted properly and replaced with George Miles, who's trying to make some sense of it, and I don't really know, and I don't understand this QEX thing and why they're trading it for who knows what station and what it's going to mean and all that. Yeah, some fundamental thing, mm-hmm. just what we need. But George has inherited this problem and is trying to do something about it, George Mile. But the problems were created by these people with their extravagant salaries and their unbelievable retirement contract. You know, they really bilked, I think. And they were properly removed for doing so. But my side is the FM radio station.
And that's in the black.
And that's in the black.
Well, that's important. Now, someone were here, and I can't find it, but I saw it this morning. You wrote something about Marcia Davenport. Mm-hmm.
The New Yorker profile.
Okay. And, of course, you have the background, the Slavic background, and she has a Slavic connection.
Mm-hmm.
And have you met her?
Mm-hmm.
What do you have to tell us? Because she's
Pittsburgh. Boy, Marcia, I'd love to talk about Marcia.
Please do. But I don't see where...
Is her grand... Was it her father or her father? Was the opera star? Who?
Her mother.
Her mother.
Yes. I'll give you Marcia in a nutshell. And then I'll also give you the profile because, in my humble opinion, it's maybe the best thing I ever wrote.
Where is this here?
You mean you're going to give us a copy of it?
Hang on, yeah.
What? I got to turn it off. Now, we're still
okay, Marcia.
About Marcia Davenport.
Marcia
and
Davenport's
the New Yorker article of what's
yes.
the date? I have some.
This came about because Fred Hetzel, the University of Pittsburgh Press, was reissuing The Valley of Decision for the first time in 40 years.
And instead of publishing at the University of Pittsburgh, right?
Mm-hmm. And Valley, of course, was the number two best-selling novel of 1944, and it's the Pittsburgh Gone with the Wind with the steel industry. And wonderful 1945 movie with Greer Garson and Gregory Peck. Anyway, he said, would I go out and talk to Marcia? And I said, sure.
And
Fred Hetzel asked you to go.
Fred Hetzel asked me to do it, and I did a little piece for In Pittsburgh. Well, I was so astonished with this woman who at 90 was... I'm not intimidated by anybody I've ever interviewed, except Marcia Davenport. She was terrifying, but also brilliant and wonderful. Her mother was Alma Gluck, the great opera singer. Her father was her stepfather, actually, was Ephraim Zimbalist, the great violinist. She wrote the first biography of Mozart in English in America in 1930, which has never been out of print since the day it was published. She was on the original staff of The New Yorker with Harold Ross, Annie Thurber, and all of the greats. So Bob Gottlieb at The New Yorker wanted me to do a profile on her for The New Yorker after I did the little piece. I called him and said, we have to do the piece, and he agreed. So I then spent the next year and a half with her off and on. I had the most astonishing...
You're going to give me that?
Yeah. I have an incredible correspondence of about 50 letters from her, and I couldn't find the one I was looking for, but we became very good friends, and then when I... Myrna took this great picture of me and Marcia the last time we saw her. And this woman is both in music and in literature, and the fact that, as you mentioned, she had a long affair with Jan Masaryk, the prime minister of Czechoslovakia, who was either murdered or committed suicide. Murdered by the communists or killed himself after the communist takeover of Czechoslovakia.
Was he the one that was in Pittsburgh when Czechoslovakia became Czechoslovakia?
Oh, you're thinking of the, of the founding of Czechoslovakia
right.
in 1918. It was his father, Tomáš Masaryk, who was the great founder of Czechoslovakia.
This is Jan?
Jan, this is Jan the son, but Czechoslovakia was created in Pittsburgh. Not quite, but the treaty was drawn up here, and I think it's in the nationality rooms. So yes, Pittsburgh is very important, and when Marcia lived here for a few years, in the 20s, she, and then again the 30s, when she married Russell Davenport, she became fascinated by Pittsburgh and the steel industry and the Czech and Slovak immigrants, which is why she wrote, what inspired her to write The Valley of Decision. And, but she was a piece of work to deal with, and the climax of the profile is that this was being done right at the time that all the turmoil was going on with Václav Havel and the revolution. And then they threw out the commies. She said, she had never been back since Masaryk was killed. She left. He made her leave Prague 2 or 3 days before he was murdered or killed himself. And she's never been back. She was the head of the American Czechoslovak Relief Committee, by the way, during the war. Never been back since the communists took over. Well, in the middle of the interviewing her for the profile, the revolution happened and the communists were thrown out, and she decided, and she had zillions of dublinas, the Czech money, crowns, in the bank in Czechoslovakia that were worthless because they'd been there 40 years, she couldn't get to them. They invited her back. They were finally translating her books into Czech. And at 90, she decided she'd go. And I said, can I go with you? It'd be great for the story. She said, absolutely not. This is much too emotional. No, 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 no way. So I asked her again 2 or 3 times. She's like, no, forget it. No, no, no. Couldn't deal with it. I don't want you there. I would be very upset if you came. Because I knew this would make a great ending to it. And Shirley Temple was the ambassador. And I knew, and I had known her, and it was going to be great. Anyway, I had this great idea. And then, but she said no 10 times. And I said to Bob, I can't go without her permission. She'd be furious. She scares the hell out of me anyway. I'm not going to show up in Prague. And about a week before she was to leave, I got this message saying, if you should want to reach me while I'm in Czech, so I will be at the following hotel. It was worded a little different. It was her way of saying, I've decided that I'll let you come. And so in about 2 days' notice, with Myrna's help, Gottlieb in New York arranged for me to go. And I was there when she made her triumphant return. And it was astounding. It's in the article. Every newspaper in Prague, they treated her as if she was the returning, conquering hero, which she was. And Shirley Temple, I had a wonderful interview with her. And she went to the ministry where Masaryk died, where he was killed. And they have a little tiny museum tribute to him there and a little guest book. And I didn't see this, but Shirley Temple told me. And it gives me chills when I think about it. In the book, they asked her to sign, to write in it. And everybody who had been there before had written, they'd write their names, and then they'd write a long thing about this is important. Lovely, it's great for Czechoslovakia. And Marcia had written her signature, Marcia Davenport. And under the comments part, she had written one word, returned, with an exclamation point. Marcia Davenport.
Well, how long have you known Shirley Temple?
Oh, for years, since I've done a lot of interviews over the years for film, and I interviewed her here once, even, in about 1979 or 80 for the Post-Gazette. She was here on a panel. I never much liked Shirley Temple until she became an ambassador. I mean, I liked her at age 3 in the movies, but her politics, for one thing, were too conservative. But she was an excellent ambassador, both in Ghana, everywhere she went, and especially Prague, Czechoslovakia. This woman took it seriously. Most of them, ambassadorships. Depending on the administration, it's a perk, it's a plum. They give them to their friends. Shirley Temple Black took it very seriously and was very respected in Prague, Czechoslovakia. Did an excellent job.
Well, Prague is an important post. Usually they give
Usually they'd put her in Luxembourg.
Funny ones, yeah. So they must have had great respect for her.
They did. By that time, she had already been. She'd proven herself in Ghana and a couple other places.
Sandra Reagan?
Bush? No, maybe Reagan. 82. Well, she was there in 89. Now, when's the profile?
So that has to be
Mary has the profile.
Profile dated is what?
82.
April 2291.
I think both Reagan and Bush. I think she was probably appointed by Reagan and continued over into the Bush administration.
This is the profile.
Yeah. It's long. Yes.
We have I'm very responsible.
You're good about return. You get credit for returning with copies.
Now, I have another profile. I hate to show my ignorance, but I don't know who Lina or Lena Basket is.
Lena Basket was my first profile.
Yes.
And it's not unusual that you would know. She was a silent film actress, star, and very important for about 3 years, and then disappeared. She had 9 husbands.
Wow.
The first of whom was Sam Warner, as in the Warner Brothers. And she encouraged Sam to encourage the company to go into this new thing called sound, Vitaphone. And the other Warner Brothers were pretty dumb, especially Harry, who ran the company. They were from right around here, Newcastle. And Harry's famous comment, Harry Warner's, was, who wants to hear actors talk? Right. Well, Sam Warner was a little smarter with the help of Lena and pushed Vitaphone, which turned Warner from a grade B. Lena used to say, before Vitaphone, the biggest star they ever had was Rin Tin Tin, and it's true. But Lena pushed him to do that. Then Sam died very suddenly after about 2 years of marriage. The Warner Brothers and the corporation maneuvered her and cut her out of the... She should have owned 25% of the whole company, but she was a 21-year-old shiksa, and they couldn't stand her. They got rid of her. She had all sorts of, you know, melodramatic things up and down. All the other husbands bought. She starred in Cecil B. DeMille's last silent film called The Godless Girl. Went downhill, tried to commit suicide, blah, blah, blah. Then it's an incredible story. It goes on and on. And she lived in Wheeling, and I discovered her for the Louise Brooks book because she was a good friend of Louise's.
To change the subject some more,
you'd be sorry you asked.
In your bio, which I read in depth, your education. We had talked about your early education, but here it says Institute for the Study of USSR, Munich, Germany. How long were you there? Tell us about it.
Oh, that's a brief story. That was essentially a junior year abroad thing, and I was there for 1 year. And it was a certificate thing that it was an intense sort of a 24-hour-a-day Russian program, and you could only speak Russian in the institute, and you could only speak German outside the institute, so by the end of the day, I was exhausted. But it was a great program. It was connected with Radio Liberty, and it was to train scholars in Russian and other Slavic languages, and while I was there is when I did my first real film Russian Soviet East European film study.
Okay, I noticed the year is 1968, so it was a divided Germany.
Very much so.
Do you have anything to tell us
about
that?
Oh, it was fascinating. It was so divided, and the Russians were so... It was also the first time I ever went to the Soviet Union, and there was still such intense hatred of the German on the part of the Russian, for good reason, that we could not be a German group. We all had to take a train from Munich to Vienna, and then fly from Vienna to Moscow, so that we would be officially an Austrian group rather than a German group, because that's how much the Russians still hated the German. And they didn't care East German or West German. They hated all the Germans. They were just as mean to the East Germans as to the West Germans. But the intensity of feeling was still so strong. But they were very nice to the Americans, and I had a wonderful time there. It was the first of many trips to Russia. And it was the Institute in Munich was where I didn't like Munich. I didn't like Germany. But it was a great institute. It was mostly Russian emigres, and they really taught us Russian. Boy, I knew how to... By the time I got there, I was conversing pretty well and knew a lot more about Russian film than I had before.
So this, you say this was like a junior year abroad, so it was part of...
In the middle of my
Columbia?
Columbia. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then I went back to Columbia and finished the following year, graduated from Columbia, 69. This was 67 and 8.
Yeah, I see that. Now, you said you've been to Russia many times. In what capacity?
First time as a student, the next two or three as... then later in Kansas, I taught Russian at Wichita State University and led several tour groups, took students. Actually, it's just a cheap excuse to go there myself and get the free trip by taking the student. And then the last time I took a group from Pitt Informal Program, Betty Goodwin, is it? And was a translator and co-tour guide for them.
How long ago was that?
I'm sad to say, the last trip I made there was, I think that was 86. So I have not been there since the Soviet Union disintegrated.
I see.
And I'm really dying to go, because I have a lot of friends over there, and I love Leningrad. Can't say Leningrad anymore.
St. Petersburg.
I can't get used to St. Petersburg. Huh?
How do you rate the movies?
How do I rate them? Oh, they're wonderful. Well, that's the whole same range as we have. I mean, they have a lot of lousy movies. They have a lot of mediocre movies. And they have some very extraordinary, excellent movies. But I am out of the loop. I cannot say. I used to be real au courant on Soviet, East European, Russian films. And since I've been into writing my own books, I have fallen way behind. And by not going there, I need to go and update myself. But they have an excellent film. Matter of fact, the Russians are the ones who developed... Well, America invented film. The Russians turned it into an art form in the 20s with Eisenstein. The Russians know a lot about film.
The Germans do too, don't they?
Germans do too.
Oh, go see Beyond Silence.
Yes, I want to see that. A lot of things I have to see. Thank God for video.
I see here that you were chief copy editor for R. Buckminster Fuller.
Fuller.
Tell us about him.
Do you know about Bucky Fuller, a little?
I know what he does, or did. He's gone, isn't he?
He's gone. He was the most brilliant man.
He looked like his dome. He was about a ton.
Yes, and they had this pop bottle, thick glass. Terrible eyesight, and he used to say, but that was good as a child because I couldn't see anything small. I could only make out the big shape.